Two sisters ride in a beat-up truck with their dad, all their possessions piled inside. From the moment they come close to their new home in the country, it's clear that spirits live there. A preteen wakes from her nap and finds herself in the last place that she wants to be. A car with her parents, traveling further and further away from her childhood home until what appears to be an abandoned amusement park comes into view. A small boy yells to his mom that he's headed to the beach, there to collect his various treasures, when suddenly he sees a sea creature who's in need. A young boy wakes, hearing yells and seeing mountains of flames collapse upon each other in the very hospital where his mother works. Hayao Miyazaki shows us where childhood and the spirit world meet, places where grown-ups might tell tales about, but rarely enter. He's infamously difficult to work for, admits to choosing his films over his family, and has tried to retire more than once. But there's something different in his new film, The Boy and the Heron, which is dedicated to his grandchildren, but also acts as an apology to his son. I included Studio Ghibli's latest offering in our Exploring Evil series because, for perhaps the first time, Miyazaki paints himself as the villain. Join me, Cindy Marie Jenkins, as we embark on a solo journey today, one of discovery, where we'll dig into mythology and biography in order to outthink the classics. Part 1. Miyazaki's Moms and Me. Today, dear listener, it's just you and me. And if we're lucky, maybe a suit sprite or two will show up. Since I was invited to a pre-screening of Miyazaki's supposedly last film, The Boy and the Heron, I got to revisit my experiences with his films and also share what I think of the renowned filmmaker's love letter to his grandchildren. Hayao Miyazaki is one of the most famous animators in the world's history. Many place him at the top along with Walt Disney, even though, and perhaps because, their approaches and styles can be so different. Miyazaki has always maintained that he makes movies for children because he feels that you can't change your mind or your ways once you reach adulthood. Characters like Mei in My Neighbor Totoro have not had their childhood violated by adult common sense, Miyazaki has stated more than once. However, as much as people say his films are anti-war or pro-environment, the auteur animator claims to never start from that place, but instead, he storyboards as he creates the story. My Neighbor Totoro is one of those movies that my father shoved into my hands during a visit. Give it a chance, he assured me. It starts a little slow, but it's better. I had two kids under three at that point, and Totoro was perfection. I mean, they had me at suit sprites. It was a lovely way to unwind from a hectic day of play dates and working from home, from setting up and cleaning from our painting adventures, and honestly, just from life in general. At that time, we watched Totoro daily. We also were bombarded by the high action, quick edits, and animation that often talked down to children. You always have your Daniel Tigers and Toy Stories, of course, but some days those beautiful films could not compete with Paw Patrol. Totoro takes its time. There's no exposition, except when the father might need help from their new neighbor. And everything about those first scenes hit me hard. To be honest, any stories about a family moving hit me hard. The sprites welcomed the new residents to their home. The young footsteps explored their new ground plan and their new lifestyle. The father set up his home office with piles of books and papers upon papers. At the time that I felt like I lived in my car, Totoro's slow and careful exploration of nature and getting lost through all of these beautiful tunnels helped me relax. Now, we never quite understand why their mother is sick. We can assume that it's something like tuberculosis, especially since Miyazaki's own mother grew sick and died from the disease, which imprinted on his soul the concept of being useful, of living life fully so that you deserve to live. He once said, "If I can entertain people, maybe I deserve to exist." I have this repressed need to feel useful. Totoro doesn't even focus on their mother's illness. Rather, we dwell in how her family lives while she's in the hospital. They move just to be closer to her in her hospital. Their father works some days from home and some days takes a bus, then a train, and we assume might walk to work. Shatsuki makes lunch for her family and takes on the mother role, the brilliance of her father's reaction when he's simultaneously surprised at the homemade lunch she hands him. He's proud of her, but also quite embarrassed that his 9-year-old must act like an adult. That animation is perfection. Shatsuki does feel the stress of her mother's illness, but it shows as a slow burn that culminates when Mei runs off and can't be found. It's a much more realistic portrayal of the stress of death looming over anyone's life when a loved one is ill. I don't ascribe to the whole concept that the daughters were dead and Totoro is leading them to whatever afterlife there is. Just to be clear, that's not something that I think is true. I love theories like that, but in this case, I just don't agree with it. Now, Ponyo is a strange film, and it's chock full of messages. Ecology, humans damaging the earth, empathy, compassion, the quality of life for seniors, one of whom is beautifully voiced by Betty White, and friendship. The moment when I bolted upright in recognition, though, is when the mother learns that the father has to extend his time away from the family for work. And she gets mad and yells at him through Morse code, then goes to the fridge and opens a beer can. She also kind of stumbles on the opening of the can. And just like that dad in Totoro, these small family moments are so raw and based in reality that almost any parent can understand. This must have been a normal situation for Miyazaki too, seeing how his very talented wife, Akemi, left her career in animation because they started a family just as his star was rising. He's often expressed regret that he was never home, always working, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. It was also never lost on me how my 3-year-old looked at the mom in Ponyo, looked back at me, probably holding a beer, and showed a clear understanding of the parallels. His dad worked away from us often at that time, and he's always been very sympathetic to the stress this put on me. Now, both Totoro and Ponyo connect the children in the film to nature. The young boy in Ponyo saves her when she's stranded on the beach. Shatsuki and Mei may miss their mom and where they used to live, but that's sort of overshadowed by meeting the Totoros, who help their gardens and imaginations grow. Ponyo's father, a human sorcerer, created this helmet for himself so he could live underwater and clean the messes that humans leave, while he's also watching his school of baby fish. Just go with it. Now, even if he doesn't set out to make films about how we're ruining the planet, Miyazaki's stories certainly help children consider the consequences of everyday life in our world and are great introductions to help families understand how both we can make small changes in our lives to help reduce plastic and trash, but also that individuals can only do so much. The culmination of Ponyo's adventures with her new human best friend, they have to convince humans and the sea creatures to live together and work together, but more so the humans. We have more information on how you can help children understand their connection to the earth on outthinkmedia.com, and I'll put that in the show notes. But no matter where you live, going into and slowing down enough to appreciate nature is the first step your family can take toward reversing the damage that we've inflicted on our world. And Miyazaki's films are a beautiful introduction for kids as to why that's necessary. We'll return with part 2, All in the Family, after this short break. Part 2, All in the Family. Before I mentioned it earlier, did you know that Miyazaki's wife was also an animator? Her name is Akemi, and her career had been on a steady upswing at the beginning of their marriage. She worked on such films as Gulliver's Space Travels, Beyond the Moon, and Horus, Prince of the Sun. Her artwork is instrumental in bringing the countryside and my neighbor Totoro to life. And if you can find the art book where Totoro was born, So many illustrations inside are from her own hand. Hayao and Akemi met as young animators, and the first intention was for their family to grow, but for both of them to keep working. In biographies, Hayao often says that he had promised her that she could work, and then had to break his promise when their first son, Goro, was young. After a few years of trying to have a household with two working parents, it just seemed that something had to give. Since at that time, Hayao was coming into his own as a director and animator with his burgeoning studio, it fell to the woman, the mother, to give up her career to be both mother and father. That's a tale as old as time, but we'll talk more about that and other just as talented people behind the scenes in February. Now, Hayao as a father has said in many interviews, with a cigarette dangling from his elderly fingers, that he's the first to admit he wasn't a good father. His wife would, quote, do all of the father things, end quote, like playing catch with her two boys, and he would work such long hours that he was hardly home before they were asleep. Their oldest son, Goro, has stated that he gives his father the highest marks for animation, but quite low marks for being a father. Not so strange, then, that Goro was intimidated by his father's talents and renown, choosing to put his own artistic abilities toward landscape architecture instead. He worked as a designer and director of the Ghibli Museum until 2005, and then was lead designer and director of the much-anticipated Ghibli Park. Now, the longtime Ghibli producer, Toshio Suzuki, once saw an argument between the father and son, and was so impressed with how Goro stood up to his father about a design that he decided it was this young designer who could maybe follow in his father's footsteps. So he hired him as an animation consultant, then a storyboard artist, before Suzuki made him the director of Tales from Earthsea. Now, it had taken many years and attempts before they got the rights to adapt Ursula K. Le Guin's Earthsea book series. I was surprised to see that this was the one story that the elder Miyazaki wrote a script for, rather than letting the story come to him through drawings as he normally does. But when you must woo such an acclaimed writer as Le Guin, you approach a work of art differently, I suppose. Hayao did not agree with his producer's decision, and was not afraid to let his entire studio know that his son was too inexperienced to direct such a film. The Studio Ghibli offices were used to their leader making his opinions known about their work, sometimes giving notes like, "They look like they have dead eyes," or even a simpler direction, "Do better." But to witness such tension in the workplace between a father and son must have felt quite different. Earthsea premiered in 2006, and we can learn about the experience through Goro's own words thanks to the Wayback Machine and his personal blog. 3rd July, 2006. Saturday last week, there was a launch party for the people connected with the movie. I got up on a stage to greet everybody, and when I took a look at the faces of all the many people sitting there, I completely forgot the words of the speech I had planned, and I was unable to give a good speech. When I think that it was through so many people that this movie was born, I became overjoyed and full of gratitude. Everybody who gave of their all for the movie Tales from Earthsea, I can't give your names individually here, but I am really, really grateful to you. And then, in the middle of the party, the color designer, Miss Yasuda, relayed a message from Hayao Miyazaki. It was made honestly, so it was good. These few words brought tears to my eyes. Of all the things he has said until now, those words of my father's brought the most joy to me. Suddenly, a positive feeling of resolve to keep doing my best welled up in me. Now, later reports were told that his father also said that he felt his son was not an adult yet, and it showed in Earthsea. Goro longed for more mentorship from his father, but it wasn't until Ponyo was released in 2008 that the two collaborated. Goro directed from Up on Poppy Hill, and it said that his father worked with him on his storytelling through animation for this film, the very thing that Goro had hoped for with Earthsea. The son has since directed an animated series called Ronya the Robber's Daughter. I watched it when it released, and I remember enjoying the characters in the story so much. I didn't find the animation particularly as engaging as a Ghibli film, and I didn't know at the time of my viewing that it was made entirely in CGI. Hayao despises CGI. He's often railed against the inhumanness of such animation. So the fact that his son has dared to defy his father in that way might tell us a lot about how the relationship works. If you were working in the Ghibli studio, maybe seeing the father and son working together meant that such a legend as Hayao could retire. He said multiple times that he's working on his last film because he's getting older and it's taking longer. And then he just returns with another masterpiece. When it comes to The Boy and the Heron, however, I think this might be the last one. Now note that there are spoilers ahead, especially for the end of the film, but I don't think that these spoilers are going to ruin your enjoyment of the film. It's really much more about other things than it is about what I'm about to say. Hayao dedicated this new film, The Boy and the Heron, to his grandchildren, with its hero, Mahito, navigating grief over the loss of his mother, a new relationship with his aunt turned stepmother, and a weird relationship with his father who builds airplanes for the army. But ultimately, the story transcends grief for what I saw as a very personal message from Miyazaki to his son Goro. Mahito has traveled to the land where the living and the dead live together, always fighting one another, but where a birthing room can't be entered, and a parakeet king desperately wants to rule this land. Yes, I said parakeet king. This is a Ghibli movie, after all. Honestly, that character came out of nowhere in the story, and I thought his subjects of parakeets were scary enough. I would have liked a little more time with him, but that's beside this point. Why can't the parakeet king rule, you might ask? Mahito's great uncle is the person who found this link between worlds and built it after a meteorite fell to the ground near his mother's childhood home. He had disappeared from the world of the living at some point and built up this alternate world. The great uncle shows young Mahito how tenuous the link between the living and the dead really is with the help of stones that he's trying to balance. He asks, then begs his young descendant to take over ruling this kingdom, and tells him that only one who's blood related to him and free from malice can be king. Mahito doesn't feel up to it for a reason I won't explain, but he never seems to be tempted or want this position, since he's been trying to find his way back to the living with his stepmother, who's carrying his new brother with her. The great uncle is assumed to die shortly after, and Parakeet King destroys this world, linking the living and the dead. Did this limbo world collapse because of the Parakeet King, or because Mahito wouldn't take the reins, wouldn't take over his great uncle's legacy? Even when the great uncle asks him, I had to wonder, who would want this role? It doesn't even seem like the great uncle enjoyed it, or maybe he once did, but is too tired and frail. It seemed very lonely, which honestly now makes me think of the end of Loki. The way that the great uncle asked Mahito to take over was also not very convincing. But knowing that this was dedicated to his grandchildren, and remembering the harsh way that Hayao Miyazaki treated his son who wanted to follow in his father's footsteps, I felt like this was not only a stunning, if circular, meditation on life, death, and grief, but also the artist's way to tell his ancestors that death is not only complicated, but they shouldn't feel the burden to carry on the Studio Ghibli legacy. That his descendants, whether by blood or mentorship, should release the pressure to be Hayao Miyazaki and learn who they truly are themselves. And I can't think of a better lesson to tie so many of these first podcast episodes together than to remind us that children, they need to learn who they are for themselves. We can help guide, we can support, but we don't write their story. And The Boy and the Heron really brought this one home to me. And that's a wrap on the fourth episode of Outthink the Classics, where we give you the historical and cultural context to decide which stories in pop culture have a place in your life today. Thank you so much for listening to the end. And for my full review on The Boy and the Heron, plus how to talk to your kids about the death of a parent, which is not a spoiler since that's the main logline on all the advertisement, visit outthinkmedia.com. Now, one lesson that I am constantly relearning is how to let our children be themselves, how to guide them without clearing a specific path. I'd love to know how you might have experienced that as a child or are now working through it as a parent. please tell us in the comments. If you like diving deeply into mythology and modern retellings, also subscribe and share this podcast with friends who would like it too. You know that's the only way we can grow, and for every one of our first 50 reviews, I'll send that reviewer a special parent primer packet. Next up is a deep dive into Roald Dahl and the question, should we separate the art from the artist? Plus, do we need more Wonka in our lives? I'll move into a little more modern YouTube territory too, on who is the modern day Willy Wonka. See you then!